Of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
They think they're living in a police state.
Once upon a time, there were these people in Europe called pilgrims, and they were afraid of being persecuted. So they all got in a boat and sailed to the New World where they wouldn't have to be scared ever again.
I loves my gun,
and I don't mean no money like I work at Walmart and make no money.
So enjoy yourself, or I'll come looking for you. There and veg out in front of your TV and enjoy what these fine people are giving you, which is maximum entertainment. You understand what I'm saying about? And don't you ever, ever, ever forget what it's like without TV. Because before TV, people just sat and played with themselves all night.
I loves my gun.
Recorded in part February 15th, 2012. This episode of Rangers A to Z is Snow Crash Part 2. Hey everybody, Iron Angel here. As predicted in Snow Crash Episode 2, I came up with a whole bunch more ideas and thoughts that I had originally intended to put in the last episode and forgot to. Before I even had it rendered out to MP3 to upload, I had realized three or four things I'd missed, and so we're going to go back to Snow Crash for a little bit longer and fill in some of those holes, fill in a couple of other bits of information, and hopefully we'll get a whole show out of that. If we don't, we'll throw in something else toward the end. Maybe another chat with Bishop or somebody like that, see what we come up with. So some of the things I forgot to cover. The name. Snow Crash implies to most people something along the lines of you know, being out in a car and having it slide off in the ditch during the snow. It actually references a book, Neil Stevenson, I believe, which has nothing to do with winter or winter survival or being stuck in a snowbank. It's actually about computers and when a computer screen goes completely white. But it's an interesting book, and I thought you might like the reference. If you don't know about this site, this might interest you. Paperbackswap.com. I like the site. It allows you to trade your unwanted paperbacks with other people. You simply pay the shipping to send them. When you sign up, you get a few credits. You can order a few books. When you get through reading them, you can put them back up. Other people want to read them. They send you a message, and you've got a few days to confirm that you're going to send it to them, pack them up, send them out. You pay the media mail shipping, and that's it. Off it goes, and you get some more paperbacks from somebody else. So you get to trade them all around. Great resource, all kinds of stuff up there. Everything from fiction to, I've even seen things like books of sheet music and textbooks and all kinds of stuff. Just nothing you're really in a hurry to get a hold of, because sometimes there's a long wait on certain books. Something that's real popular just came out, that kind of thing. Quite often you'll see there's a wait of, you know, 60, 70 people, so it might take a while for you to get it. I've even had a few rare books come in through there, so that's very handy. So maybe you want to add Snow Crash to your list of stuff. And you know what? I didn't say that much in episode 2. I was really good about it. And this time around, I'm not working off a sheet just yet, so of course I'm back to doing that again. And I'm trying not to. We'll work on that, eh? Other things we didn't cover. This media, all the media that we produce at Rangers, is free to distribute and share as you like. If you want to make a copy of this or any other show episode, hand it to a friend, hand it to your mom, whoever, feel free. Granted, with the music I tend to choose, mom and grandma may not be that keen on the music, but there's some stuff in here, and if you want to go through and edit out the music, feel free. You're perfectly welcome to do that. Obviously, the background music's a little hard to get rid of, but as far as the audio tracks between our segments go, you're free to edit those out as you like. You're absolutely free to distribute this. It'd be great if you give a reference as to where it came from. You know, if you're going to burn it in CD, can you put R4NGER5.com on there for us and let people know where it came from? Hopefully somebody can use something out of this stuff out there. If you've got friends up north, feel free to grab the URL and send them a URL and say, hey guys, you know, I know you get stuck in the snow, I know you got some stuff, but there might be something here new that you missed or an idea you didn't have, whatever. That said, let's see. We didn't get everything I wanted to hit on home stuff. There's the again. Boy, you know, if you guys got a nickel for every time I said every show you listen to, you get a free cup of coffee out of. Maybe better. There it is again. Oh, joy. Houses. When you're snowed in, a lot of people will do a couple of things that aren't necessarily a good idea. You get fidgety and you start going out to the refrigerator. Every time you open the refrigerator door, you're letting the heat from the house into the refrigerator and you're letting the cold from the refrigerator out, so the things in there are getting warmer. And if the power is out, which is why you're having problems, that's not necessarily a good thing. If all else fails, if the power is going to be out for a fairly good period of time and it's that cold, you can take the stuff out of the refrigerator, put it into a big cooler, and put it outside in the snow. The cooler's there not to keep the food from going bad or from anything like that. It's to keep the neighbor dogs and kids and things like that out of it. So you may have to put something on top of it just to keep critters out of it. If you live where we do, out in the middle of the woods at night or on the edge of town like we are, there's a good chance you've got either roving wild dogs or raccoons or possum or some other critter of the night out there. So you may want to put a brick or something useful like that on top of it to keep it from having problems. We didn't cover cooking that well, and I've covered it a little bit. We just glanced over it in episode 1 slightly. When it gets cold like this, if you have a charcoal grill, an outdoor charcoal grill, do not bring it inside and fire it up. Not only will the smoke be an issue and the carbon monoxide and everything else, it's just not safe. Just not safe at all. There's absolutely nothing that says you can't grill outside, though. If you got a gas grill, absolutely go outside and grill. Have fun! If you fire up a charcoal grill outside, obviously you want to keep it away from the house a little way so you don't start the siding on fire or something awful like that. But if you get a charcoal grill, there's a couple of really great tricks that you can use that for, because it's gonna produce heat for a fairly long period of time. Once you light it, you're gonna have heat that you're not gonna use otherwise. Use that heat to your advantage. If you've got a steel bucket or a pail, something like that you can put snow in, just keep adding snow to it until you get a nice big bucket of water. Dump that off into a 5-gallon plastic bucket. Obviously, don't put a plastic bucket on a charcoal grill. Something bad will happen almost immediately. It'll start to smoke. The smoke is acrid, is toxic, is not good for you. But if you've got a metal something, if need be, you can put a big pan on there. Generally, the modern painted and enameled pans don't like being on charcoal grill very well. Cast iron will work. It's not a good idea for it, especially if you get it hot and then add snow to it. You could crack it really easily. But if you have to, you can put cast iron on, make sure it's got snow in it to start with, mound it up, keep some water in it all the time so you're not adding cold snow to the pan itself, you know, just the raw hot pan. Although with the water in it, it's not going to get real hot. If you put it back on there, wander back in the house, goof around for a half hour, 45 minutes, and come back out, you'll have problems. The best thing to do is always, anytime you got a fire, a candle in the indoors in the house, the charcoal grill going outside, somebody should be within line of sight of it all the time. You should never leave a fire unattended. It's just not a safe thing, and there's always the possibility of something going wrong you just hadn't foreseen. Flying squirrel jumps off the roof and knocks it over, and the coals go up underneath the car, and next thing you know, the car's on fire, and it's a lot of excitement you don't need. Okay, so flying squirrel attacks are rare, but you get my point. Once you've got that grill going, if you've got a charcoal grill, you've got a lot of heat. There's a couple other really handy tricks. You can do this with a gas grill, too. If you've got some big rocks out in your yard, go get them. If they're river stones, rounded, polished river stones, there's a good chance they've got water in them. If you heat them up quickly, they will probably split. And if you do that, your wife is going to be miffed. Don't do that. Set them aside, set them off to one side so they get warm. If you have to, wrap them in foil, because the grill will get them kind of sooty and dirty and nasty. But you can bring large stones in and set them on a pan or a plate or something like that on a table and let the stones radiate heat back into the room as well. It's kind of a weird way of doing it, but it actually works pretty effectively. Wrapping the stones, if you've got a stone that is going to possibly split and you don't care if it splits or not, wrap the stone up in 5 or 6 layers of foil. That way, if it does break, it's not going to throw hot shards all over the place. And it's likely to break on the fire. It's not very common for it to break after it gets off the fire. What happens is there's water trapped inside the rock that builds up pressure and you get steam in there. This is why it's not a real good idea to do this with blocks of cement. A lot of cement still has some water trapped inside of it somewhere because cement's very porous. As that water heats up, it creates a steam puddle inside of it that will eventually split the stone. Now, there's a number of other things you can also heat up to use as a heat source in your house. Let's say you've got a charcoal grill. You've got a couple of say, empty paint cans, for example. You can fill them with sand. Now that it's frozen, it's going to be a little challenging, but had you set aside some sand or you've got a sandbox you can unshovel, and we'll come to shovels here in just a sec. You can get some sand in there and fill up a metal container and heat that up. You can bring that in the house and set it on a hot plate of some sort or trivet. Anything to keep it from scarring, from possibly charring or chewing up or getting dirty the top of whatever you got it setting on. And use that as a radiant heat source. Another really handy little trick is to take a fired clay, non-painted, non-glazed flower pot and turn it over on top of a candle. Not directly on top, set it up above the candle a little ways. The big 3-inch pillar candles work really well. You've got to have that pot sitting on something that isn't going to burn. 3 smaller pots, if you've got them, works just fine. The terracotta, the basic unglazed terracotta, has no problems with heat. And some heat will go out the hole in the bottom. That's not a problem. What you're trying to do is diffuse the heat through the room more. Instead of having just a column of heat rise up off the candle, you're trying to get the heat diffused. And the terracotta itself will heat up and act as a radiant heater as well, some too. These are readily available at most big box stores, garden stores, that kind of stuff, early in the spring. In the winter, they're a lot harder to come by. So if you got a few sitting in the garage that you had planned on planting and stuff in and never got around to, you can dig them out and use them for that. You want about the height of the candle above them, which may or may not be an accurate term. If you just have a stub of a candle, you don't want that thing sitting down there as close as you can, because it'll choke the candle and soot and cough and smoke and all kinds of nasty crap. Let's say you want the width of your hand minimum above them. The terracotta should be, say, 4 inches or so up off the top of, say, 60 centimeters if you're, you know, if in the UK. Up off the top of the flame, standing on something that isn't going to burn. Now, in this case, you can use cement. If you've got a couple of cement paver bricks or something like that sitting around, you can use those, and they'll work just fine. All you need is something fireproof, inflammable. Even cans will work. You could use cans of soup or cans of tomato soup, beans, what have you, because they're not being directly heated. They're basically just acting as a support. 3 or 4 of them in a circle with the candle in the center and then the terracotta pot sitting on top of that will help give you a little bit more heat into the room than just the candle alone will. 3 or 4 of these on a table. Obviously, you've got a couple of safety concerns when you're dealing with candles. If you've got small children or pets, they may be curious about what you're doing and don't really understand what they're being involved with. Pets particularly don't really understand, so you got to keep them off the table. And this is why you have somebody always watching candles or any kind of heat source. But let's say you're back out on your deck. You've got either a charcoal grill or a propane grill, and you're out there cooking and grilling and stuff like that. Use that extra heat. Use any extra heat you can to melt snow so you've got water to flush the toilet with. Can't hurt. If you have to, it's not a bad way of heating up water so you're not using the water out of your hot water tank to wash your face with, to wash your hands with, that kind of stuff. By not draining your hot water tank, if your gas is out, or if you have an electric hot water heater, this will keep your hot water tank hot for many days, and you don't have to worry about that freezing and splitting. If it ends up being a very long-term situation, you may have to drain your hot water tank. If it looks like your power is going to be out for, you know, 2-3 weeks, you're not going to have gas, you're not going to have any method of getting hot water to it, you may have to drain your tank. There is another way if you're on city water. if you're on a well, you're going to have to know how to drain your tank. That's something you'll have to learn how to do. Obviously, you'll need some sort of catch basin. You're going to have to catch up to possibly 80 to 100 gallons of water and move it away from the tank. You don't want to just drain on the floor. That's just asking for trouble. So you'll need to investigate that. You'll need to educate yourself on that. That's something we can't really help you with directly because there's a lot of different possible scenarios there. If you're in an area that has city water, you might be able to protect the pipes, both the drain pipes and feed pipes, as well as the tank, by leaving both your hot and cold water faucet open dripping. Figure out which faucet is the last faucet in the line. Quite often, one room will be where the faucet or the plumbing terminates. Looking underneath you, sometimes you'll be able to find the actual lines that end. They come up to that, and they'll go a little further and then come upward. And they just stop. And it looks like maybe they're going to build another story or something like that. They're not. That's actually there to prevent water hammer. If you don't have a air shock in the line, when you turn that off, the lines will jerk. And in some old houses, you can hear the lines jerk and rattle when people turn on and off the water or flush toilets or what have you. Your toilet is another possible water source. The water tank in the back is usable water for something if you need to. Not a great idea because quite often they're not kept real good, real clean, real good water, but it's there. If you have to, get your water to a good full rolling boil. Skim off anything on it, and that water can be melted snow too for that matter. Get it to a good rolling boil on your charcoal grill, or if you've got a Coleman camp stove, take it outside and turn both burners on. If you've got a big metal pot, perfect. You're good to go. At that point, the boiled water is relatively safe. There are some things that will survive being boiled. Snow on the whole is pretty safe, though, to begin with. So boiling snow gives you relatively safe water. Actually, boiled snow water is quite often safer, depending on what the atmosphere the snow fell through is like. Where we're at, where you get into these sorts of situations out in the country, there's not a whole lot of chemical pollutants in the air for the snow to catch on the way down. And we can take the water here, boil it, and have it tested, and often it's actually safer, more pure water than the city tap water is. And the city tap water is pretty decent. The big issue is, this is what happens when you go to some other country. You go to, let's say you go to Mexico and you're not used to, you're from, say, Boston. When you get to Mexico, you're going to have Montezuma's Revenge almost immediately. And nobody there does. It's because they're used to what's in the water, you're not. They have an immunity built up to it, their body's used to it, it's not an issue. If you stay there for 3 months, it'll stop happening because you drink the water and you go, okay. Your stomach eventually goes, all right, these guys can be here. We know them. They're cool. So that is a possibility, but it's an unlikely possibility. Most of the time, snow is pretty pure. It tends to be condensed water from high atmosphere, high altitude. You get more contaminants in rain than you do snow, and most rainwater is pretty clear, depending on where you live. Obviously, there's certain areas that have acid rain and things like that. That's a whole other series of shows and stories and things to deal with there. Let's see. We heat up sand. We heat up rocks. You can take that hot sand and spread it out to get more heat out of it quickly if you need to. You basically pack your... You take the grill itself out, set your sand bucket down in there, pack the coals up around it, let them burn completely out. Take that sand in and then spread it out on a cookie sheet, setting on a table or something like that. Hopefully stood off. Put some spoons upside down underneath if you need to or something to get it so there's an airspace underneath. And it doesn't leave a big scarred spot on the top of your table because your wife will not be happy or your mom or whoever. But that'll put a lot of heat into the room rather quickly. The problem is, of course, then you've got all the heat in the room and it's lost. If you have a large mass of hot stuff, it'll stay warm for a much longer period of time. So it's a trade-off. But both of those work very effectively to help assist you using what would otherwise be waste heat. If you've got a gas grill. If you've got a gas grill, you can go out and turn it on and off. The big problem there is going to be in cold environments, the tank will freeze. A lot of people don't realize, because they don't draw hard enough, that liquid propane has a tendency, when you draw off a lot of it quickly or over a long period of time, the bottle itself gets cooler, which comes in handy for a few things. There's a few uses for that, but that's a whole other topic. We'll cover that somewhere else. And in the winter, it can already be cold enough that it's not off-gassing very much, so the gas you are pulling out of it is dropping the temperature down low enough that the tank is freezing. If your gas grill acts like the flame is fluttering and is not staying lit very well, you may have to turn it off, take the tank off, bring the tank in the house, and let the tank warm up to 40, 50 degrees for a while. It'll take a while because there's a great deal of mass there. If you've got a couple of 5-gallon buckets of water sitting in the bathtub, you might set it into one of the 5-gallon buckets of water so just the base of the tank is sitting in water, and that'll help heat it up quite a bit. It doesn't need to be boiling hot water. It just needs to be above freezing. So, you know, even if the water sitting in the tub is only 55 degrees, you're pretty safe to bet that's going to help thaw the tank out. And that's an interesting bit of trivia. As far as I know, in most places in America where it does freeze in the winter, where you do get snow, water comes out of the ground roughly 55 degrees. There are some variations. It's rarely colder than that. But generally speaking, most places are 55 degrees or warmer. I've heard of it being as low as 48 in a few places, but most places the water comes out of the ground at 55 degrees. There's thermal mass in the ground. If it's really cold and you're not getting the temperature back up, if it's been many days and you've got a basement, go into your basement. By the time your house gets down into the 40s, your basement will be holding at 50, 55 degrees. And the reason for that is thermal mass. The radiant earth heat coming out of the walls is going to stay right around 55 degrees. The problem is if it's not well insulated and there's air blowing through somewhere down there, this is how you get frozen pipes. So it's possible that the air underneath your floor is colder than that. But in a deep basement with good seals, good windows, that kind of stuff, there's a good chance your basement will stay 50. Which is not comfortable, which you can get hypothermia from, and you can actually freeze to death in 50 degrees. Or not freeze to death, but die from hypothermia shock. But it is an emergency measure if you absolutely have to, if you get trapped, you know, you're snowed in somewhere for multiple weeks. And I don't know of a case where that's happened in the U.S. in a while, but I suppose it could. I don't know the history of Alaska very well. It's certainly feasible in Alaska. Those folks are a lot more used to it. So ask the locals. You know, if you moved from, say, Florida or Texas up into the North Country, you moved up into Fargo, North Dakota, ask the locals what they do. Observe the locals. Figure out what they do ahead of time because they're used to it. It's not a problem for them. Dealing with the locals, we were, I don't know, about 10 years ago, we were heading out west, and we were going through Kentucky. We stopped in Kentucky. We were going to a historic reenactment event over the weekend. And when we got there, we found out that because of the snowfall the night before, the venue had to change. They were concerned about the roof collapsing. Their area did not usually get a lot of snow. Their buildings were not built for a great deal of snowfall. It was only about 17 inches of snow, which for us is, you know, that's a Tuesday. That's not a big deal. But where they were, they really weren't used to that. Their buildings were not designed for it, and so they were having concerns about the roof collapsing. This is something you may have to consider. If you're in a building with a fairly flat roof, particularly a fairly flat roof that's not very thick, that's built with, say, 2x4 ridges, rails, rafters, that kind of stuff, you may be in some danger from that. If you believe that you're in that situation, stay against the inside walls, the load-bearing walls. If the roof does collapse, it's going to break in the center and drop with two panels diagonally. You'll be in a safe spot. Granted, it's going to suck. If at all possible, you're better off to stay in a section that doesn't have the real flat roof. I had a house years ago that half the house had a very steep roof and half the house had a very flat roof. And in the winter, I had a lot of problems with ice building up on the very flat roof. But when we would get those really astonishing snowfalls, we had a 32-inch snowfall one night, and that extra weight on the roof was a safety concern up there. So we were staying out of that particular room, the kitchen, just because we weren't sure that the roof was going to take the load. We were not aware of a load that heavy on it in years, so we weren't sure the roof was ready for it. If it's something like a garage roof, you can get up underneath of it with some poles and brace it. Some big long chunks of steel braced on the floor up against the roof itself can give you some support. Make sure you're bracing against the rafter so it's spreading out the strength over an area and not just putting a pole against the plywood the roof is made out of, because otherwise the roof will slide down around it and punch a clean hole in the roof. And it could make things collapse a lot faster accidentally. If you can, rafters slightly diagonally so that they're not going to fall over. If the roof does lift up, the pole will slide in against the rafter further and not just free fall and smash whatever's sitting on the bench. Further, if it's going to be a few days before you get power back and that kind of stuff, you may want to go out and shovel snow around the base of your house. It adds an extra layer of insulation. Snow is surprisingly insulative, which is why you see survival courses teach snow caves and that kind of stuff, is because you can actually insulate yourself in snow. And we're not going to cover that. That's not really a basic survival, a basic everyday thing. That's pretty extreme stuff. That takes some education if you're going to go backpacking or hiking in the mountains in snow. That's a whole other course that we're not going to get into in this show. Things like avalanches, all that kind of stuff, are all concerns that you have to deal with in those environments, and that's much more advanced things that we're covering here. This is basic everyday stuff for, you know, it's just the things that could happen, and because we're covering specifically winter emergencies, we're covering, you know, what happens at home. And if you live on the side of a mountain, you really do need to educate yourself about avalanches and snow caves and all that kind of stuff, because it all could be very important at some point. You may never use it. Hey, if you didn't use it, you still know about it. You can be a fiction writer and use it in fiction then. Snow and snow shoveling. A lot of people end up dying from heart attacks out shoveling snow because they end up working too hard. Part of it is they don't know how to shovel snow. Part of it is they're really horribly out of shape, and it's the only exercise they've gotten in the last 6 months. But let's cover snow shovels real quick. There's a lot of different kinds of shovels that are sold as snow shovels. For me, I found that the one that actually works the best is not actually listed as a snow shovel. If you go to a farm supply store or someplace like that, you'll find what they call a grain shovel. It's a big plastic shovel, fairly wide, fairly deep. It makes it pretty easy to move snow with. It doesn't take real kindly to being beaten against ice to break ice up. But then again, the curved kind of scoopy snow shovels don't do real well at that either. If you need to break up ice, there's a lot of better ways to do that. A rounded wooden, like the end of a baseball bat or something like that, smashed into the ice will sometimes cause it to break up and break loose. If you have to actually hammer on ice, a rubber mallet, it's going to shoot out chunks and things, so you're going to want some sort of eye protection, if not a full face shield. But a rubber mallet's not a half bad way of breaking ice, because when it does go all the way through, it's not going to tear up what's under it. Your deck isn't going to get all chewed up from the edge of a shovel or a hammer or something like that. If you're up on your roof trying to break off ice, that's just asking for trouble. There's a few other really sneaky ways of doing that. You can lay something up there that's black. A black piece of plastic drain tubing will collect sun and work its way right down through the ice in a very short period of time. A couple of days of good sun, you'll have a channel all the way down to the roof. Up north, where we get a lot of snow and ice, you typically see either steel flashing or aluminum flashing along the edge of the roof that allows that stuff to come right off without any real problems. But on shovels, the big grain shovels really are, they don't make a really good slide down the hill kind of shovel, but they don't weigh a lot. They're relatively inexpensive. The big aluminum ones are more rigid, more solid, a lot harder to break, but they cost a great deal more. And if you're in an area that doesn't see a lot of snow, they're not terribly useful. What's really handy about the big plastic shovels, if you're in an area that only gets a little bit of snow a year, it's also a great shovel to have for picking up leaves. It's about a little narrower than the opening on a leaf bag, and you can pretty easily use that and a rake together, kind of like giant chopsticks or giant salad spoons, to stuff leaves into the leaf bag. And that gives you a tool that does more than one thing. One of the Ranger's concepts is, what does it do and how well does it do it? And in this case, it does a couple of different things, and it does all of them fairly well. You can use these things to shovel sand with, but I really don't suggest it. They're just not quite strong enough. For little sand work, like leveling out a kid's sandbox, play box, that kind of thing, they're pretty good for that. They certainly work for shoveling grains and things like that. If you've got a couple of large animals that you got to move grain around for or level out straw and hay, which is what they're really intended for. They're intended to get up into a corn crib and shovel out corn cobs or what have you. A lot of people think that a pointed steel shovel might work. Well, it'll break ice just fine if it doesn't dig up whatever's underneath it, your sidewalk, your deck, your car. But because the blade isn't very wide, they don't do a real good job of shoveling snow. In a pinch, if you got nothing else, yeah, that'll work. But so will the cookie sheet. You have to bend over. You just about end up crawling around on the ground to do it. But you can use something like a cookie sheet in a pinch if you don't actually own a shovel. Heavy, thick snow, the stuff that the plows throw up, is a lot more difficult to shovel through. You don't really want a big, wide shovel for that. You use your big, wide grain scoop to shovel your way out to that stuff. And at that point, you want to use something that's narrower. That's the point that you get out your pointed spade shovel, your hole-digging shovel. And use that to break up the heavy chunks of slush and ice, and then get them all loose so you can get them out of the way with the big grain shovel. I can almost guarantee if you try and slam a big chunk of ice to crack it in half, your grain shovel will lose that fight. So, probably not the best bet there. But last time I bought one, I think it was about $12. I live in an area that they're really common, so you may have more difficulty in finding them, and they may be more expensive. Always go out and look at your options, see what does the job best for you, because each person is individual and unique, and you may have something else that's absolutely perfect for you. I will say I've used the Backsaver shovels, the ones that have that weird little scoop in there. I didn't find them to be that much help on my back, really. For general, just kind of pushing the snow down the sidewalk kind of thing, they weren't particularly great. And for throwing snow, they were a little better than a short-handled straight shovel, but my T-handled grain shovel seems to do a better job for my body. Your mileage may vary. So I've managed to yammer on for half an hour about things that I forgot last time, and I'm still not even close to done. So it's time for a music track, and I don't have anything else that's really holiday themed, so we'll throw in something completely different here.
Show for it now. And if it leads working, I'm working, I'm working, I'm working so hard, trying to change my game, gonna raise my bar.
I'm working, I'm working, I'm working, I'm working so hard, gonna stay up all night, gonna push it far.
Was MCO Big Ben, who you can find on SoundCloud, doing, let's see, what track was that? That's RPM 28 Days, another one of the RPM Challenge tracks from this year. Thanks a lot, Big Ben, for letting me use that. The second track, I have to admit, I wrote that. It's a piece I wrote for RPM some years ago. One day, my buddy Gumbo Stew wandered in the house. The house was quiet. He just kind of sat down and recorded it. Surprised him, surprised me, surprised everybody involved. If you go to alonetone.com, look for Gumbo Stew, G-U-M-B-O, space S-T-U. You'll find him there. He's got a lot of neat stuff up. Definitely listen to his version of my song because it's a whole lot better than mine was, so... Yeah, don't even worry about looking mine up. Just go right straight to his version. At the end, we're going to play a couple more songs from folks I know through that. And Full disclosure there, I'm going to use another cover on the way out, so yeah. Anyway, back to dealing with the addendum for Snow Crash, the things I forgot the first time around. Turns out I had a bit more to waffle on about than I originally thought, so let's get back into that. Now your house should be fairly warm and safe and all that kind of stuff. Hopefully you've not been up on the roof trying to slide off wearing your shovel and all that kind of stuff. Getting around on the ice is sometimes a nuisance. There's a lot of folks that get hurt over the years going out, trying to get to work, trying to get out and clean their car off, stuff like that. There's a couple of ways around that. You can buy these little slip-on ice cleat deals for your shoes. The reason we didn't cover chains under cars is because a lot of places no longer allow chains. There's an awful lot of states that chains are just outright outlawed. Even in the snowy states, you still can't have chains because they tear the roads up something awful. Same thing with spike tires. You used to be able to have tires that had little steel spikes in them. But people like to drive on the roads when the roads weren't all that snowy and icy and stuff, and they just chewed the roads up something awful. Now, on your feet, that's a different story. I've seen people go out in their golf cleats. I suppose it works. In something like, say, packed snow where the cleat can dig in, it does work pretty good. And you can buy these little slip-on deals that basically have a waffly metal spike on the bottom of them, and they dig in pretty good. In a pinch, go to a pound shop or a dollar store, depending where you live, and get a couple of dog leashes. Keep them in your car if you need to. Keep them wherever you need to, next to the door, what have you. Just wrap them around your foot and clip them back into them. So you'll have to wrap them around four or five times. Usually a dog leash is about 6 feet long. It'll take a bunch of wraps to wrap around your foot. Start up underneath the arch so it doesn't slide off very easily. Wrap it around reasonably tight and clip it back into itself when it gets completely around. And you can walk on that on the slickest ice there is and have pretty good traction. You're not going to be doing any kind of marathon sprints or anything like that, but you can get out and at least get groceries and stuff, get stuff out of the car and not have to worry about falling on your can. If you find yourself in an icy parking lot, just sort of shuffle along. Do what we call the penguin walk up north, where you are only taking very short steps, not even the full length of your foot, so that your center of gravity is always over both feet. It makes it a lot easier to keep from falling down. Yes, you look stupid. But you know what? You don't look stupid on your butt, do you? So that's kind of a bonus. And, of course, your coworkers will laugh at you until they fall on their butt, and then they'll find themselves doing exactly the same thing, and then you can laugh at them. So the other thing to be really conscious of is on ice, hills are really a nuisance. Almost all roads are slightly crowned. If you're driving along in an ice storm, you'll find the car wants to come off to one side. The car will tend to pull toward the outside. Let it. If there's no curb there, the shoulder of the road will usually be rougher, even if it's just packed snow, and give you better traction. If you have to drive with two wheels off the road, granted, you can't go 70. You know, it's cruddy out. Don't drive fast. Don't be stupid. We up here get a lot of people that, I got a four-wheel drive. I can keep going 70. No, you can't. You can go 70 all the way into the ditch. And at that point, you're going to be back in there a ways, so we're going to have to work hard to get you out. We're going to leave you for later. We're going to help the normal people out. If you feel you can drive 70 and do it, hey, great, have fun. Get your emergency kit together, you're going to need it. But for the most part, you know, you drive for conditions. When it's real icy, two wheels off the road will let you run 25 miles an hour without any real problem. In areas with curbs, it's much more of a challenge because the curb will rub on the sidewall of your tire, and that's not good for the tire. It can damage the tire. And it has a tendency to cause your vehicle to jerk and you can't steer for beans. However, usually next to the curb is a relatively flat area for drainage. If you can get your wheels into that channel and out of the main polished track, you can probably keep moving along 10-15 miles an hour. No, it's not quick. Yes, it's boring as snot. You still get there in one piece. Obviously, you know, if it's going to be a day where there's a lot of rough weather out, leave early. Expect it's going to take three times longer than normal. If you get there early, hey, you're there early. Read a book. Goof around. Whatever. same thing goes for getting home. You know, just because the day's over and you want to be home, fully understand that. I totally understand that. But you want to get home in one piece. We don't have to want to come, you know, fish you out, especially if the vehicle's upside down on a river or something exciting like that. That's just excitement you don't want. That's an adventure story you don't need for a radio show like this one. Have I been, you know, have I slid off before? Oh, yeah. Have I used some of this silliness to get myself out? Sure have. I had a vehicle that had some uncanny ability. It apparently had a giant ditch magnet in the back end of it, because invariably I found myself in the ditch with this car. Now, granted, you know, being young and stupid and inexperienced, that didn't help matters a whole lot. Having four bald tires didn't help matters a whole lot. Having no weight whatsoever didn't help matters a whole lot. So the combination of those three, this car was just a ditch magnet. And I had a tow chain with me, and pulling a car with a tow chain, if you don't know what you're doing, is extremely dangerous. If you jerk that chain, there's a good chance of breaking the chain. If you break a chain, all the force that it had on it, you know, that 2,000 pounds of car, suddenly has to find someplace else to go, which is usually through your back window. That's excitement you don't want. One, it's awfully cold driving around without a back window all winter. Two, the possibility of getting whacked in the back of the head with a big, heavy piece of chain kind of sucks. Having glass all over your back seat kind of sucks. Let's not do that. But a 6-foot-long length of heavy chain, you can lay under a tire in ice, and I seem to get off of ice a lot. You know, you get the car up into the snowbank, and the front end get caught on the bank, but the back wheel was sitting on ice, and I couldn't go. So you get the chain out, you put the chain underneath the tire, and you just gently, you put it in gear and idle it back onto that chain, and the tire will spin a little bit, grab the chain and pull up underneath, and quite often you can drive right back out on top of the chain. Same thing sometimes works with branches. You can use pine branches for the same effect. A lot of times they'll just spin out. A rough board can sometimes work. We've had a case where the car got trapped up in the air. We had an all-wheel drive Subaru that got trapped up in the air. As long as the car had a wheel on the ground, it was okay. It could have gotten out of what it was in, but it was sitting on a big block of slush and ice and crud. So we just jacked the car up and shoved a wheel under a board underneath one of the wheels and packed ice and snow up underneath of that, so it had a little bit of traction and got going and got itself off the ice. Creative misuse of the equipment at hand will get you out of a lot of situations. Always look at things safely. If you're dealing with a stuck car, you don't want to be in direct line with the wheels or even within about a 15-degree arc of the wheels, because they could throw something very easily. Making something that was just a nuisance into a medical emergency is something you just don't want to do. You know, the biggest safety item you own is your brain, and you've got it with you all the time, so use it. And I don't mean to be condescending in saying that. People get stressed out. They get in a situation, and they just kind of go nuts. You know, they go, well, you know, and off they go, and they let themselves get caught up in the moment. They don't sit back. First of all, laugh at it. It's the best thing you can do. Just sit back and laugh at the situation. Well, crud, here we are. Well, this is an adventure. This is going to be a story for later. A couple of my friends have got some absolutely fantastic stories that started with, you know, I'm stuck in a snowstorm. And either the weirdos that came and pulled them out of the ditch, or them pulling somebody else out of the ditch. I mean, literally, one of my buddies got stuck, got himself out. As he's getting himself out, another car gets stuck just up the road from him. It was basically, you know, rubbernecking, looking back at him, and so we got to help this guy out. And the guy, of course, is embarrassed. You know, he didn't rub it in or anything like that, because that would be kind of a jerk thing to do. And the two of them standing there getting this other car out, you know, they were standing there part and company, and a third car slides. And so, you know, before it was said and done, I think they pulled out three or four cars out of the same spot. And it turns out the top of the bridge had black ice on it. Everybody come up over the top and just kind of float. And, you know, so even if they hadn't been rubbernecking, it probably would have had cars in the ditch. And black ice is ice you can't see. Black ice is usually ice that's also wet, which is what makes it not reflect very well. Wet ice, buttered glass is not as slick as wet ice is. And anytime you've got pressure on ice, quite often that pressure will produce some heat and produce water. So if it's right around freezing, the weight of your car can cause otherwise dry ice to have water on top of it, which makes stopping a lot more difficult. Obviously, if you're in an area that you're not used to driving on snow and ice and you get some, this is a fantastic learning opportunity. Go out to a big empty parking lot and just play on it. Try not to hit a pole. That would suck. But for the most part, it takes a lot longer distance to stop. It takes a lot longer distance to get going. Just ease into it, relax, laugh about the situation, look at the funny parts of it, because you know these are going to be great stories around the campfire come next summer when it's, you know, 75 degrees at 10 o'clock at night. So that really kind of covers a lot of the things that I forgot in Snow Crash 1. There was something else. Oh, yeah. I know that in the first episode we mentioned 15th-generation apartment dwellers, and Bishop mentioned people that are proud of that. Now, if you happen to fit into that category, and you're trying not to be, rock on. Congratulations, dude. You're doing what you need to do in life, okay? There are some people who are basically ignorant. They just don't know. Ignorant doesn't mean anything terribly negative. It just means you don't know something yet. I am ignorant to so many things in life, it's not even funny. There's a whole lot of stuff that I keep trying to teach myself about that just doesn't seem to stick. But basic stuff like this, if you can teach yourself these basic skills, hey, rock on. You are a better person than you were before. You can now deal with something that otherwise used to terrify people like you. Maybe not you yourself, but, you know, people in your situation. And that goes for all the stuff we do, all the Rangers Media. And here's the other thing I forgot. This was another important thing. If you're in an area that you could get into this and you're easily forgetful like I am, make copies. You are absolutely welcome to make copies of this stuff. Keep this episode and Snow Crash 1 on CD in your car. When you're sitting there waiting for a record to come or waiting for a friend to come help you out or just trying to get warm, listen to it. We might have covered something in here that could save you a lot of trouble, save you a lot of frustration. Maybe even some swear words. Hey, there you go. So, also feel free to copy these and hand them out to people. Absolutely more than welcome to. If you would, could you write our website on there for us? R4NGER5.com. That's rangers.com. You can get all of our media there, all kinds of different radio shows about different stuff. You can even see V Out Wild Camping in the back of England. There's a bunch of stuff there. We're going to close with two tracks from The Culprits, also available on AloneTone.com. The first one is Brains, the second one is Goth Song, and it's their cover of one of my songs. Hope you enjoy. And again, that's The Culprits, C-U-L-P-R-I-T-S, I believe. Remains or living flesh, we're not that.
but you might join us. Scream, you wish this was a dream. Our methods seem extreme, but there's only so many ways you can get into somebody's skull.
Get yourself in tune.